Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guest.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm Marty Shankman, and I'm here to talk about estate tax planning in the current environment. It's now the end of March 2020. Coronavirus is a major issue. The CARE Act has been issued. The election results are not predictable for the November 2020 election, and clients need to plan their estates in the current environment. There are a number of significant, unique factors with planning in the current environment. Clearly, from the massive government bailouts, taxes are going to have to be raised. We have talked in the past at conferences everywhere how if there's a Democratic victory in 2020, the proposals that President Obama made to make the estate tax much harsher in his Green Book in each year of his administration, the proposals Senator Sanders and Congressman Gomez introduced to the Senate and House respectively, and the various proposals talked about by the Democratic presidential candidates would all call for harsher estate tax. At this juncture, given the massive bailouts and more may be coming, the increase in taxes is almost inevitable regardless of the outcome of the election. Let's take a look at what's going on in the current environment and specific planning techniques you as advisors may want to discuss with your clients. But let's start with a estate planning basic, which I know you all understand, but I think it's important for a moment or two to just review based on the current environment. It's also important because when you have an estate planning discussion with clients, it's certainly great to talk about tax minimization, which they should, frankly, everyone of wealth consider now. But in addition, you want to make sure that clients have addressed their basic estate planning. So often, clients do not go back to their estate planning attorney, and it is not uncommon to find clients that have documents like wills that are 5, 10, 15, or more years old, which is certainly problematic. So start with going over the basics. You all know what they are. Make sure the client has a current will, revocable trust, and I'm going to comment in a moment about that. It's a different environment now. Power of attorney, which gives an agent authority to act for financial, legal, tax, and other reasons. Healthcare proxy, living will, and HIPAA release to address healthcare decision making. In the current environment, we need to address what's different about those healthcare documents. I recognize you're not going to draft them, but if you're meeting with a client, you do want to point out some of those issues. So step one is encourage clients to make sure all their documents and planning are updated. Here's a couple of things that are different and unique in this environment, and frankly should change going forward. The issues of signing documents remotely is very problematic. We're not going to get into that. I have another podcast on the PFP site that discusses that. But the problem may in part be addressed if clients move their planning to use a simpler, shorter pour-over will that pours assets into a revocable trust, and a revocable trust is their primary dispositive document. So that's something that is new and something that I frankly think going forward all clients should defer to as the standard structure for their planning. Let's take a minute, and again, I know you're not drafting documents and it's not your focus, but I think it's so important that it's worth a minute or two of time and talk about how the healthcare-related documents for you and your clients as well, also for yourselves, need to change in the current environment. Let me just explain very quickly what the healthcare documents are and then explain the two points that I think are different in the current environment and frankly should be corrected going forward even after we get through the current coronavirus difficulties. The documents include a HIPAA or Health Insurance Portability Accountability Act release. It's a fairly simple document that authorizes a named agent to communicate with doctors, receive private health information, and so on. It's not a decision-making document. It's an access to medical information document. Living will is a document in which a client expresses healthcare wishes, end-of-life wishes, et cetera. and a health proxy in which a client appoints somebody to make healthcare-related decisions. Practitioners are well familiar with these documents, certainly estate planning practitioners are, but it's critical that they be properly addressed. In many instances in the past, an agent would be in the hospital, communicate with physicians, and sign whatever documents necessary to make a medical decision. With the highly contagious nature of coronavirus and the overwhelming impact on the healthcare system, that's not going to happen. So as a result, what's going to be done is remote communication will have to occur. Most of these healthcare documents don't contemplate that. So one of the things you might want to suggest to your clients, and it may be a good reason to motivate them to address updating the documents with their estate planning attorney, is remote decision-making needs to be addressed in the documents. And that can be done with a simple document change that incorporates into the document a provision that authorizes the agent to communicate with medical personnel remotely using Skype, Zoom, or any similar type of communication tool, as well as email, or that PDFs of signed documents or electronically signed documents should suffice as well. So that's a change that should be made to everyone's medical documents, and not only for the current environment, but frankly going forward. The second issue, which again is not an issue accountants primarily deal with, but it's just so fundamental that I believe it's important to incorporate into what you do with respect to your estate planning discussions with clients, and that is the healthcare decisions that many clients have made. There are free forms available on the internet, and frankly, even forms professionals have created that provide for an absolute mandate to not have the client intubated. In other words, not put on a ventilator or breathing machine. Just language from the standard form I found online says, I do not want under any circumstance, even if I may recover, to be put on a ventilator. Something like that with the current coronavirus situation is almost a death sentence. With coronavirus, which attacks the lungs, and that's the reason for the dramatic worries over the number of ventilators available, a perfectly otherwise healthy client with a health proxy like that might not be put on a ventilator. If they were intubated and put on a ventilator, they well would be able to survive in many instances. So it's simply inappropriate to have a blanket provision like that. Also consider that with ventilators being in such short supply, if a triage occurs and a hospital has to make a decision who should and should not be put on a scarce ventilator, somebody with a healthcare document that says do not intubate me no matter what may well lose the opportunity. So those are some reasons that I know are beyond your bailiwick to address, but they are important because clients are not aware of them and clients may not be going back to their estate planning attorney. So if you're having an estate planning discussion, I encourage you to make it broad and address these issues as well. Now, let's change gears completely and get to things that are absolutely in your bailiwick as tax planners. The current environment at the end of March 2020, and I'm giving you the date because things are so fluid and changing so rapidly, things may change. And even if they do, the planning ideas I'm going to give you, you can adapt, but I think it's important to know at what point in time I'm speaking so that you know how the environment may be different when you're listening to this or planning for a client. Here are some of the environmental circumstances going on at the time that we're doing this, and it'll all pertain to the planning we talk about. The stock market has declined fairly substantially. I believe now it's 25 or 30% from its heights. The impact on valuations generally in terms of private equity and real estate holdings is uncertain but potentially significant as well, and we're going to talk more about valuation issues later in this discussion. The interest rates are near historic or at historic lows, and they may even go lower. So we have an environment with reduced asset values, we have an environment with low interest rates, and we have an environment, which I spoke about earlier, where by next year, whether as a result of the election or just the need to address deficits, we may well face a dramatically harsher estate tax environment. Finally, in the current environment, as you all know, the exemption amount is $11.58 million. So many of our clients have substantial estate tax exemptions they haven't used. We could see a decline in the estate tax exemption that is dramatic. Thus, many of our clients who may not be subject to an estate tax because of the depressed value of some of their assets today or because of the very high exemption may well be subject to an estate tax as early as next year should they die. So it's really critical that clients take advantage of the current environment and that we tailor our planning tools to address the potential for significant increases in estate tax, that we address our planning in a way that contemplates using a low interest rate environment and takes advantage of the currently and hopefully temporarily depressed asset values. One of the more significant issues that we're going to face as planners to get clients to move forward is psychological. How can we get clients that are fearful from the decline in the markets and their asset values, fearful for their lives and their health because of the coronavirus, to move forward? I think that if we reframe the conversation to focus on opportunities and the benefits of planning, if we reframe the conversation by starting with, Mr. Jones, Ms. Jones, are your estate planning documents current and do they really reflect what you want? If we start with the basics, we may be able to get clients off the mark to start planning. So those are just a few thoughts. I don't have a better answer for how to get clients off the mark, and too often clients do defer planning beyond what they should. Now, let's talk about some specific planning techniques for the rest of our program together. First, one of the Democratic proposals that has been floated a number of times is that any assets in a grant or trust will be included in the client's estate. The vast majority of trusts, I believe, for years, maybe much longer, have been structured to be grant or trust. And we've used grant or trust historically in planning because we could have a swap power to bring appreciated assets back into the client's estate. We can have transactions such as a note sale with the trust from the client and not trigger income and so on. One of the changes, again, has been proposed to have assets in a grant or trust because of the huge benefits I just mentioned, taxable in the client's estate. We have no idea what the effective date of any such legislation would be and how it may impact planning. Therefore, one of the things to consider suggesting to clients is if a client has an existing trust that does not contain the mechanisms to turn off grant or trust status, they may want to decant that trust into a new trust that provides specific steps to turn off grant or trust status. In that way, if there's a change in legislation and the effective date doesn't grandfather the existing trust, we can at least turn off grant or trust status. For new trust, what should be done is each of the powers that can trigger grant or trust characterization should have a mechanism to turn them off, and I'll give you a couple of examples. If a client that sets up a trust, the grantor, has the power to swap assets, that swap power will almost assuredly characterize the trust as a grantor trust. The trust instrument could provide a specific mechanism for that power to be renounced. Another common power that's been used historically to characterize the trust as a grantor trust has been the ability for a person in a non-fiduciary capacity to loan trust assets to the settlor, the grantor, without adequate security. That person holding the power, the provision that creates that should expressly permit the person to renounce the power. Here's another thought that I don't really feel has been discussed maybe ever that you might want to mention to your clients and suggest to their estate planning attorney when you meet to review planning. Why not create a special power in a non-fiduciary capacity to be held by a person named in the trust to take any of the steps to turn off all grant or trust status? So that person could have an overarching power to terminate the right of anyone else to loan money to the settlor or for the settlor to swap assets. One of the issues that creates grantor characteristics that creates grantor trust status is the ability of a spouse to receive distributions from a trust. So if I create a trust for my wife and she can receive benefits, that characterizes as a grantor trust. But if I created some type of spousal lifetime access trust. I don't want my wife removed as a beneficiary, but nonetheless, I may still want grantor trust status terminated. How can that be done? Adding an adverse party that is required to approve distributions to the spouse. And that may be the mechanism to give this person holding this overarching power. So to summarize, we started by talking about the current planning environment. We talked about some of the healthcare documents in general, basic estate planning steps you want to encourage clients to take. We talked about turning off grantor trust status, which could be quite important depending on what happens with future legislation. Let's change gears and talk about GRATs, grantor retained annuity trust. GRATs have been a common planning technique for many years. They're sanctioned by regulations, which give fairly detailed recipe, if you will, for what has to be done to make a GRAT viable and work. In essence, when you put assets in a GRAT, a grantor retained annuity trust, the client will receive back an annuity amount that is basically the return of principal, and if you will, a rate of return based on current interest rates. So if a client put $1 million in a GRAT and received back $500,000 and perhaps say $520,000 just to make up a number at the end of year one and another $520,000 after year two, they'll have received a return of the principal plus an interest component based on the statutory rates, the regulatory rates. And if there's any appreciation above the $1,040,000 return to the client, that's all out of the estate, estate tax-free. GRATs should not be used as the tool for a client who has not used exemption. Exemptions are very high, $11.58 million in 2020, and will decline under current law in 2026 by half. But if there's a change after the election or next year just to address the burgeoning deficits, having used the exemption is probably the most powerful tool. So only consider GRATs for wealthier clients that have used up their exemption. I don't think in general it's going to make sense to use a GRAT technique if a client still has remaining exemption they haven't used. Now, GRATs traditionally have been set up as what are called rolling GRATs. In other words, I'll do a GRAT this year. Next year when I get an annuity payment, $520,000 in my prior example, I'll create a new GRAT and re-GRAT that $520,000. And by gratting and regratting, it becomes what are called rolling or cascading grats. You're constantly feeding assets into the grat and shifting the upside appreciation over the 75-20 rate out of the estate. It's important to understand that because that may have a significant impact on how we do grats in the current environment. For years, when we've done grat planning, we've presumed that any annuity payments out of a grat or if a grat failed, because the growth wasn't sufficient to really exceed the 75-20 rate, all those assets would be regratted. This gave rise to a fairly typical grat plan of two-year rolling grats where you would just grat and regrat and regrat and keep shifting all upside appreciation out of the estate. But if, in fact, after the 2020 election, the laws are going to change and the proposals for grats from the Sanders tax bill, President Obama's Green Book for many years, and then to require a 25% gift, a minimum 10-year term, and other restrictions that basically emasculate grats to the point where they won't be used. So we have to rethink fundamentally that if we're doing a grat now, the regratting, cascading rolling grat technique that has been the hallmark of grat planning may no longer be available. What does that mean in practical terms? If a client's used all their exemption and wants to use grats to shift assets, they may very well be better off using a 6, 8, 10-year ladder of grats to take as much advantage as they can of the technique because regratting may not be permissible. So that's a very different approach to grats than what we've historically done, but might be absolutely important in the current environment. Using longer-term grats will change how we administer grats. In the past, if a grad had a large bump up in value, for example, somebody bought Zoom stock in a grad that they just did at the end of March, in mid-March 2020, and the stock skyrocketed, you may want to substitute cash for the Zoom stock, pull the Zoom stock out, so you've insulated or immunized, is the term often used, the grad from downside risk. But if you have a two-year grat, it may be perfectly acceptable to a client to hold cash that you immunize a grat with for 2 years. That's not going to be the case if we have a 6, 8, or 10-year grad. So the whole immunization process is going to have to change and become more complicated. And you'd want some more astute financial steps taken, perhaps a somewhat diversified but conservative portfolio with hedges, so that you have some potential for growth and not merely leaving the assets in cash. So that whole concept has to be revisited. I apologize, but I didn't state specifically in our grads discussion why grads are so appropriate now for clients that have little or no remaining exemption. The answer should flow from my introduction to this topic, but just to reemphasize in the context of our grad discussion, interest rates are at historic lows and they go down further. Asset values have been depressed by the decline in the stock market. So low asset values that may recover and very low interest rates all speak very highly to the benefits of grads. Another concept to keep in mind when you structure grads is to get as granular as possible. Now, that doesn't apply if you're using a family business to fund the grant. But if you're using marketable securities, you don't want to fund a grant with a diversified portfolio because the diversification process is designed to have winners offset losers and vice versa so that you modulate the risk inherent in the portfolio. Instead, what you'd want in a grant is to be as granular as possible. In other words, maybe create 5 different grants, each with a different asset class. If the numbers values are large enough, you could get as granular as having different securities in each separate GRAP. One final GRAP planning concept that's worth considering is something that's been called a 99-year GRAP. In that concept, what you're doing is creating a very long-term GRAP. You know the client's not going to outlive the term of the GRAP. But wait, you say, if you don't outlive the GRAP, all the assets of the GRAP are included in the client's estate. That's not correct. The technical calculation of what is included in the client's estate is on the client's death, you take the annuity payment divided by the then current 75-20 rate and come up with the value of what's included in the estate. So if interest rates are so incredibly low today, for argument's sake, say 1%, but by the time the client dies 20 years from now, interest rates are at 5%, the calculation of the amount that's included using the formula I just gave you could shift a very substantial majority of the assets outside the client's estate, even though the grant supposedly failed. So a 99-year grant may be a very interesting tool to use. In particular, if you find very wealthy clients who have used up their exemption, have still not done all the planning they should, and the election looks like it may go Democrat, and that we may have a reduction, dramatic reduction in the exemption amount and the restrictions on grants, a 99-year grant may be a last great Hail Mary to throw before the new law comes into effect. Let's change gears and look at loan transactions in the current environment. Interest rates are at historic lows. Intrafamily loans have always been a great planning tool with incredibly low interest rates and asset values dropped significantly at the time that we're speaking now. A simple intrafamily loan may be a very powerful and inexpensive and simple planning technique. Mom loans money to daughter. Daughter pays mom the required interest rate, which is insignificant, invests in the stock market, which if we have the V-shaped recovery people are talking about, all that growth will be in the daughter's name and not in mom's name. So a simple family loan works. I know as practitioners, you're very familiar with the critical requirements of having formalities of a proper loan, a written signed loan agreement with a state of maturity date, an appropriate interest rate to avoid the OID rules, and so on. Make sure clients adhere to all the formalities. Ideally, interest should be paid annually, and so on. Now, having just said that interest should be paid annually, in some large transactions, it may be difficult to pay interest currently. There may not be a problem if a client loans funds to a grant or trust of deferring or stepping the interest. Be aware that it'll trigger the OID original issue discount rules, but with a grant or trust, it may not matter. The key is you want to make sure that all the other indicia of a valid loan are met, even with the step or deferred interest rate, because the key risk is the IRS challenging an interfamily loan as being a gift, and that could have very substantial tax costs. If mom loaned money to daughter and daughter didn't have the wherewithal to really pay it, so it wasn't a valid loan, the IRS could argue because the daughter had inadequate resources to pay the loan, it should be recharacterized as a gift. Or if daughter didn't adhere to the terms of the loan, didn't pay interest, there's no signed loan agreement, it can be recharacterized as a gift, triggering current gift tax. In general, when these transactions are done, if they're at a sizable level, it should be done to a trust, not to the individual family member. So the incremental growth above the interest paid is in a secure trust, hopefully it's feasible, GST exempt, and so on. Another family loan concept to keep in mind is practitioners should go back and discuss with every client that has had loans made, for example, large note sale transactions, and consider whether or not those loans could be renegotiated. If the loan doesn't prohibit early payment, prepayment, you can renegotiate the interest on the loan and take advantage of the current lower rates. Some practitioners think that if I sold a large asset to a grantor trust and now I'm paying 4%, I want to bring it down to a current rate, which is dramatically lower, I need to get some consideration for being willing to do that. Some may make the loan term shorter. Some may add additional collateral. Other practitioners don't feel that's necessary at all. If there's no restriction on prepayment, you could borrow money from the bank, which is certainly a smarter way to do it, repay the loan, and substitute a lower interest loan. Because of the very low interest rate, because of depressed asset values, sales, note sales to grantor trust could be an opportune planning a step to take right now. And again, bear in mind that with the restrictions on grantor trust, restrictions on dynasty trust planning that have been proposed, that type of plan, elimination, restriction or elimination of discounts, note sale transactions that have been the hallmark of planning for many larger estates for a long time would effectively be almost eliminated with some of the proposals the Democrats have made. So now may be an opportune time, low interest rates, depressed asset values, and discounts available, and the technique arguably still works under current law. So this may be an ideal time to propose to larger clients doing note sale transactions to lock in discounts and shift growth out of their estates. Another topic is late allocation of GST exemption. So for clients that may be unwilling to make gifts or transfers today, if we can go and allocate GST exemption that they're not going to otherwise use to trust that we're not GST exempt, we can get some substantial tax benefit. One of the areas where I think this is quite common is life insurance. Often life insurance trusts were not structured to be GST exempt. Too often life insurance trusts were frankly improperly structured or less than optimally structured, where the kids would get, the heirs would get the money, say at age 30 or 35 following the death of the last parent or the parent that was insured. We would want to decant those trusts into new longer-term trusts and then make a late allocation of GST exemption. In general, keep in mind how powerful late allocation of GST exemption can be. If a client made a gift to trust for children with grandchildren as remainders, that trust might be able to be decanted into a longer-term trust. It may not have been structured as a GST-exempt trust. If the assets given to that trust, would have been valued for GST allocation purposes as the date of gift. But when you make a late allocation, it's the value on the date of the gift tax return that governs. So if the value of assets is declined and it wasn't GST exempt, it could be a very opportune time to make a GST exempt trust. I think we also need to discuss with clients life insurance because of the economic difficulties we're living through now. Some clients will go and cancel life insurance. That could be the most inappropriate thing if we face much lower exemptions. So we should counsel and advise clients to review with us as their planners any life insurance before they cancel it. If they have a cash flow issue, there may be a lot of other options to address payment of that premium or to defer payment than canceling it. Let's change gears and cover one last topic, and that's valuation. So in the current environment at the end of March 2020, there's great fear in the economy. I know the CARE Act was just passed, and it will have some beneficial effect, but the unknowns about when businesses will reopen and the economic impact on businesses has to have a twofold impact on valuation. First, what are future cash flows? If you have a client that has a chain of restaurants and they're all closed, what are the future cash flows from that business? How do you project them given the current uncertainty? Second, any future cash flows once projected have to be discounted. And if the discount has to incorporate current risk and uncertainty, clearly we have substantial risk and uncertainty in the current environment. So it may well be that the discount rate is higher, cash flows are lower, and hence a lower value for valuation purposes. Final comment on estate planning and valuation is with respect to probate after a client has passed, we need to make sure we have alternate valuation dates on our radar. I have not seen this come up in my practice for many, many years. In 2008, 9, 10, we saw significant alternate valuation date events where we could use the value 6 months following the date of death because it's so much lower than the value at the date of death in order to value assets for estate tax purposes. Given the dramatic declines in the stock market and the economic uncertainty we're living in at the end of March 2020, alternate valuation date should be on your radar. So just to recap and conclude, we've talked about getting clients to address estate planning, starting with the basics, trying to motivate them by focusing on opportunity and the importance of planning before there's a change in the law, which could come with the next election and frankly could come regardless of the election, given the substantial dollars used for fiscal bailouts. We've talked about a whole range of planning ideas from different uses of GRATs and applications of GRATs in the current environment and why they may be so helpful, but again, different than we've historically done. Family loans, note sale transactions, and a range of other planning considerations. I hope this has been helpful for you. On behalf of the PFP section, this has been Marty Shankman. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I highly encourage you to visit the PFP section website and all of the guidance to help you through COVID-19. Stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, who will tell you how to find this valuable resource. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit aicpa.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.